thank you for touring the inside of the Backus Page House Museum. Feel free to pause the audio tour to look at additional artifacts in each room. Your admission assists with general operating costs and special events and projects throughout the year. Before going inside, let's talk about the outside of this beautiful brick home. Speaking of bricks, how many bricks do you think it took to build this house? Go on, give it a guess. The Backus Page House contains an estimated 72,000 bricks, and due to the variations in color, it is very likely that they were made right here on the farm. Was your guess close? John E. Pierce, who donated part of the land for John E. Pierce Provincial Park, stated that the bricks were made out of clay obtained from the ravine at the rear of the house. The clay was trampled by oxen in order to make it malleable, and then the bricks were shaped with a wooden mold. They were left out in the sun to dry. These are called adobe bricks. The outer walls of the house are 3 and 4 bricks thick. Many of the inside walls are 2 to 4 bricks thick. The Backus Page House was one of the first brick buildings constructed in Dunwich Township in 1850. The Backus Page House is of Georgian design in what is termed Federal Empire style and reflects the American origins of the Backus family and of the training of the builder Robert Morris. Morris immigrated from Wales to the United States and completed his apprenticeship in Philadelphia. He moved to the Talbot settlement because he found out that there was work available here. Morris constructed many other homes in the area, including the Beaubier home, now Victoria Manor in Dutton, and the addition to the Stephen Backus house, currently owned by the Littlejohns. He also built the steeple tower of St. Peter's Anglican Church. Morris completed all the work on the house, such as the woodworking, brickmaking, lath, and plastering. This 2,800-square-foot home was built using virgin oak and black ash beams and joists. The 3 original fireplaces were hand-worked with paneling and mantles of black walnut. The floors in the home were tongue and grooved by hand. According to a visitor, the style of trim is the same as 1840s New York brownstones. Many houses of this time period had a summer kitchen off the back to keep the heat of cooking out of the main part. There is a roof line visible on the back of the house and a white outline. We believe this was a summer kitchen and later a woodshed. You've heard a lot of settler names so far, and you might be wondering, just how did Backus Page House Museum get its name? We're named after the first and the last residents of the house. The first residents were Andrew and Mary Jane Backus, and the last residents were Morley and Grace Page, hence Backus Page. Before entering the museum, please leave any pets, food, or beverages outside. You are welcome to take pictures, just be sure to tag us on social media, at Backus Page House, for Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, Facebook, and more. Let's go inside the back door and see how Andrew, Mary Jane, and the Backus children lived during the 1850s. They did have 12 children, but only 6 lived to adulthood. You have now entered the kitchen, where the floor in here and the entranceway are made of black ash. Mary Jane Backus spent hours in this room cooking on a wood stove, preparing meals for her family. What's one thing you notice is missing from this kitchen that you have in your modern kitchen? How about running water? Mary Jane and her daughters would have had to travel back and forth to the well for any water needed, not just in the kitchen, but for bathing, laundry, and house cleaning. That's why we've placed the buckets and shoulder yokes near the back door, since they would have been used frequently throughout the day. Note the stove in the far corner. It is a fully functional replica of a step stove, known as such because of the oven box being above the range, giving it the look of 2 stair steps. There are 4 burners plus 2 warming places on top of the oven. Mary Jane would have dried herbs, clothing, and kitchen linens on a drying rack above the stove, as well as using an outside clothesline. Water for laundry would have been heated up on the stove or in warmer weather outside on a fire. The family would have eaten their meals here in the kitchen unless there was company to warrant using the dining room. A local diary states that the Backus family ate their first meal in the home during the summer of 1851. Walk through the door between the wood box and step stove into the pantry. This room would have stored all of their foodstuffs and been the site of all the prep work and washing up from meals. In front of the window is the dry sink. Water would have been dumped into the large tub and used for washing dishes. The dirty water wouldn't have been wasted though. The daughters, or Mary Jane herself, would have emptied the basin into the garden to water plants. The blue cupboard in the corner is a pie safe, where all baked goods would have been stored to keep out insects and rodents. The flour bin in front of the window is to store flour, as bread was part of almost every meal. In the 1850s, we were starting to get into patent medicines being sold through advertisements in newspapers and magazines. You could order the medicines, and they would arrive through the mail. But sometimes your local general store, in Tyrconnell, would have patent medicines available to purchase. We have various sizes and colors of bottles on the upper shelf. Since there wasn't a doctor in the area at the time, Mary Jane would have used herbs from her garden and plants found in nature to make salves, tinctures, teas, and poultices for common ailments. She, too, would have used these types of bottles for storage. You can see one bottle on the shelf, still with most of its label and contents, claiming to be snake oil, used as an antiseptic which might reduce the possibility of infection. Walk through the door to the Backus's parlor. Children would rarely have been in the parlor. Parlors were the showroom of the house and were designed to show the outside world how prosperous a family was. They were filled with furniture and decorations that were not used every day by the family. Usually the rooms were dark and gloomy, as blinds were kept drawn, furniture covered, and doors shut. As well, for many families, it was expected that the parlor would be furnished once in a lifetime. The trim in this room is black walnut and the floor is white pine. The piece of trim which serves as the baseboard was made out of a different wood and stained to match the rest of the trim. Beside the fireplace is a spittoon for men who chewed tobacco and needed a container to spit out excess tobacco juice. The long body clock to the left of the fireplace depicts a scene from the Napoleonic War. The clock, library chair, yellow upholstered occasional chairs, etagere, footstool, and small table with drawers predate the house. Please proceed into the front hall. Notice the clothes railings. This was typical in a farmhouse of this era. The front door is the original door from when the house was built. It is made of white pine, which weathers well. Even though the surrounding parts have been redone, the door itself has survived the years. This is the entrance that guests would have used, but there are stories of Andrew Backus coming in from the fields across the road and tramping his muddy boots through the front hall to the kitchen. The hall tree has a connection to the Black family, who were established in the Tyrconnell and Wallacetown area early in the life of the community. These are the original stairs, although simplistic in appearance, reflect the great skill of the carpenter. The spindles and banister are black walnut. There is faux painting on doors, trim, and woodwork, an excellent example of the skill of the painter. This type of art required years of training and application, and has no comparison to today's standards. It was recommended that faux painting be used where possible to replicate existing woodwork. Please continue up the stairs and remember to use the handrail. Let's begin with the bedroom to your immediate left at the front of the house. Notice the original door handles on the doors upstairs. Perhaps this room was the master bedroom because it is the only one with a lock on it, or perhaps many of the children slept in this room together. In here we have four examples of beds. There is a day bed just inside the door that would be used as a bed for sleeping or for sitting and lounging. A cradle for a baby is in front of the window. Underneath the large bed, you will notice a trundle, truckle, trumble, or hurley bed attached to casters. This is a great space-saving way to add more sleeping area. This would have been a young child's bed, as it prevented them from falling out of a higher bed and kept them close in case they cried. From Little House in the Big Woods by Laura Ingalls Wilder.
By the time the dishes were all wiped and set away, the trundle bed was aired. Then, standing one on each side, Laura and Mary straightened the covers, tucked them in well at the foot and the sides, plumped up the pillows and put them in place. Then Ma pushed the trundle bed into its place under the big bed.
The big bed mattress is held up by ropes. These needed to be tightened frequently to prevent the mattress and its occupants from sagging in the middle. If you've ever heard the term sleep tight, this task is what they were referring to. Mattresses would be stuffed with straw, corn husks, or any suitable plant materials and required frequent changing. Since most people only had two outfits of clothing, one for work and one for church and special occasions, you didn't need much room to store clothing. You'll notice that none of the bedrooms in the house have closets. This room has a wardrobe that originated at the Pierce homestead down the road. We've set out our collection of chamber pots, a bedpan, and commodes from primitive to very nice, and outside we have a replica outhouse. Chamber pots were used during the night so no one had to find a light source and make the long trek outside to relieve themselves. In the morning, you would take your chamber pot with you to the outhouse to be emptied, and bring it back inside to be washed and put back under the bed. During the day, you would use the outhouse, or if out in the field or forest, you went where you could find a modest place. As for supplies, the luxury of toilet paper was unheard of. Folks used leaves, fur, corn cobs, or pages from newspapers and magazines. Joseph C. Gayety of New York was the producer of the first packaged toilet paper in 1857. It consisted of moistened, flat sheets medicated with aloe named Gayety's Medicated Paper, and Gayety's name was printed on every sheet. Most residents in our area would not have purchased this medicated paper, but would continue to use the more economical leaves, rags, and newspapers. Please move on to the next bedroom on your left. Both this and the previous bedroom floors are made of white pine. Notice the clothes railings that run along the walls where you could hang your clothing or night clothes. This was quite characteristic of an 1850s farmhouse. This room has both a dresser and a trunk for more storage if needed. The log cabin quilt sitting on the bed is made out of old dress material and is at least 135 years old. Some beds would have a straw mattress which could become filled with bugs if not changed. Hence, don't let the bed bugs bite. On the washstand is a hair receiver. People would save their hair when they brushed or cut it to be woven or plaited and put into lockets, to be left visible through cut glass windows of a brooch, to be made into watch chains, bracelets, or jewelry, and to be placed inside a pincushion so that the oil from the hair coats sewing needles, making them easier to slip through material. Please move on to the next bedroom on your left. This small bedroom was probably used as the children's room. It would have got most of its heat from the kitchen below and the heat rising up the stairwell. In the window, there are slates for school and some toys. The little horse made of bone was found in a post hole on the Stephen Backus farm. The floors in the rest of the upstairs rooms, including this one, are made of tulip. We've placed a hooked rug in this room that was made by many museum visitors over a 3-year time period. This is a hit-and-miss pattern that uses cloth scraps, but it adds so much color and warmth to a room. Notice the closed door. Please do not enter this next room. It is for staff only. This room is interesting because the walls have never been finished off until staff and volunteers added a coat of paint in 2014. They have never been, previous to our restoration, painted or wallpapered, and the floors have never been finished. For both the Backuses, the Pages, and our museum, this is a storage room. Because the families didn't have a basement that was not damp, they used this room to store extra belongings that were not used every day. When Morley and Grace Page lived on site, he stored his maple syrup buckets in this room, according to his daughter Iris. Please take a moment to sign our guest book on the little table. If you leave us your email address, we will keep you up to date on museum events and news. This last room is dedicated to Mary Story. Little did Mary Story know when she arrived in 1809 that her 200 acres of land would someday contain not only a church and a manse, but a cemetery, a provincial park, walking trails, a museum, and a house that once was an antique store. Mary settled on Concession 10, Lot 11. Mrs. Story lived on part of one lot, and her son Walter, who had married but never had children, lived on another part. The first school in the settlement was built by the community on her land in 1824, and it was 18 feet by 22 feet. The school fell into decay, and another school was built down the road in 1835. She was a sincere and devoted member of the Church of England. It was her generous donation of 10 acres of land and money in 1827 for both St. Peter's Church to be built and land for a cemetery. When she died, money was left by her for the building of a parsonage. She is buried in St. Peter's Cemetery. She was a hard-working pioneer of Tyrconnell. When Mary arrived here, she brought with her a loom, spinning wheel, and tools needed to produce textiles. There are stories that she sold Colonel Thomas Talbot linen for shirts. We have on display some of our quilt collection, all our spinning wheels, wool winders, and more. Please take a few minutes to add some stitches to our quilt or hook on our current rug. Notice the size of the floorboards in the landing. They were cut out of tulip wood. It would be very difficult to find planks of this size today. The Backus family had a loom on this landing and spent many hours weaving here. The ample sunlight from the window facilitated this type of work. The loom currently residing in its place near the window is actually a barn loom. It's too large to have been the original. However, evidence, marks on the floor and walls, indicates that a loom would have stood there. Originally, when the Backuses lived in the home, the woods that you see across the road were clear cut to the lake to see the ships coming in. That's how the house got its original name of Lakeview. It has only been since the ministry has taken over the land that the area has been replanted as a wooded area. Please continue back down the stairs using the handrail and to the right into the dining room. This room was definitely the dining room because of the connecting door to the kitchen. The wood is white pine. The chimney that houses this fireplace is divided into two, and there is a fireplace in the room behind. The windows in the house are called 6/6 after the 12 window panes. If the carpet under the table is pulled back, the floor under the dining room table isn't finished. The Backuses would have always had a rug down, therefore no need to finish that small patch of floor. We have evidence in the fireplace that it was once used to cook on before the arrival of a stove. In the fireplace is an eye for where a crane would have been to cook over. This would have been used before and likely after the wood stove was installed, even just to keep water boiling for humidity in the winter, and of course warm drinks. We have on display a replica of a stagecoach. After 1817, the Talbot Road was extended and considered the best in all of Upper Canada. Two main branches for stagecoaches were the London to St. Thomas, Port Stanley, and Port Talbot, and the second from Fort Erie to Sandwich and on to Sarnia. The first stages began operating in the 1820s, but were seldom better than an open wagon or sleigh. In 1837, Mrs. Anna Jameson visited Colonel Thomas Talbot and went on to Chatham in a farmer's cart pulled by two horses. The bottom of the wagon had clean straw, and both her seat and the driver's made from slung straps. The driver was a respectable settler from the neighborhood who charged $12 for the two-day journey. Corduroy log roads made travel bumpy and uncomfortable. Water and mud were issues, and many a traveler had to assist drivers in getting their coach moving out of holes. On bad roads, you could travel 2 to 3 miles an hour. Coaches would stop at inns to change horses, have passengers disembark or get on, or get refreshments. By 1842, a daily line of stages operated across the province, mostly due to mail delivery. In the early 1850s, there was a complete trunk line from Quebec to Detroit, intersected by many branches. Stagecoach proprietors had long-term contracts with no competition in their area. The covered coaches kept in the vicinity of the larger towns where the roads were better and where it was worth an effort to take in the unwary. Six people could sit inside, three to a bench, and another person up front with the driver. Baggage would be located at the back and light baggage on the roof. 30 to 75 miles a day was the usual speed with long delays and inconveniences. By the 1870s, stagecoaches were being replaced by the railroads. Please move into the next room using the door to your left. The fireplaces are distinctive and reflect the Regency period in their design. They were constructed in a mortise and wooden peg old world craftsmanship manner. They reflect the skill and age of the craftsman, in this case, an older craftsman who was probably trained in Europe. The family that built this house had 12 children, however, 6 died within the first few years. At that time, the woman spent a large part of her day in the kitchen, so this may have been a room for the children. The presence of the fireplace is a good indicator that it was used for small infants because there is a direct source of heat. The room was also used by Mary Jane when she was sewing or performing other everyday tasks that women in the 1850s did. Rooms such as this one were also used by an elderly parent that could have moved in when they were no longer able to take care of themselves and go up and down the stairs. Please take some time to look through and purchase some souvenirs in the gift shop. All proceeds go to support the operations of the museum. Tyrconnell Heritage Society is a volunteer organization that relies on donations, memberships, and volunteers. If you are able to assist either with a donation of your time or finances, please speak with our staff before you leave. Continue out the back door of the museum kitchen and have a look at the replica outhouse to the right of the ramp. most outhouses contained two holes of different sizes, a larger hole for the adults and a small hole for the children. Most children would learn very quickly not to sit on the bigger hole unless they wanted to fall in. Outhouses were not cleaned out back then. They waited until the hole was pretty full, then dug a new hole near the old one and moved the outhouse over the new hole. The dirt was then put over the old hole's contents, worms ate the material, and as the dirt settled, more was placed on top. Outhouses were not just used by farmers and regular folks. Some of the wealthier Victorian outhouses would have fancy decorations on the roof and intricate wood trim. Please walk around to the front yard of the museum. We have some trees planted in memoriam to former resident Morley Page and society volunteer Richard Phelps. There is also a Japanese maple planted in 1937 when Edward VIII abdicated the throne to marry Wallis Simpson, and Edward's brother, George VI, took the throne. Grace Page listened to the radio, and at the exact moment that the crown was placed on George's head, the tree went in the ground. The tree is plaqued as a heritage tree. Please continue to the front gate of the museum. There you'll see our Route 1812 sign, explaining the effects on the settlers on Lakeview Line of the raids on the Talbot Settlement in 1814. Feel free to walk or drive east on Lakeview Line to the entrance to the Outlook portion of John E. Pierce Provincial Park. On August 17, 1959, the tract of wooded land across the road was donated for a park by John E. Pierce. A large plaque designed by Donald Inman was unveiled at the opening. The Page family sold what is now the Backus Page House and the adjacent property to the Ministry of Natural Resources in 1965. The Tyrconnell Heritage Society entered into a 50-year lease with the Ministry of Natural Resources in 1997 and operates to preserve and promote the history, culture, and area surrounding the Backus Page House Museum within the Talbot Settlement. Thank you for spending part of your day with us and letting us share the history of the house with you. We hope you will come back to one of our special events and tell your friends about us. Should you have any comments, suggestions, or compliments, please let one of our staff or volunteers know or send us a tweet at Backus Page House or email info@backuspagehouse.ca. Please enjoy a walk through the park, gardens, and grounds. And again, thank you for your support of Backus Page House Museum.